I always get reminded, you know, how show business is such a lie, because it's just like, yeah, we're going to take a break. Oh, we're right back.
Are you saying I'm corrupt? Hi, welcome to GeekWire. I'm GeekWire editor Todd Bishop.
And I'm GeekWire co-founder John Cook.
We're coming to you from GeekWire in Seattle, where we get to report every day on what's happening around us in technology, science, and innovation. What happens here matters everywhere, as we like to say. And every week on this show, we get to talk about some of the most interesting stories we've been covering. I'm pleased to introduce our guest commentator this week, John Devon. John, it's great to have you here.
Great to be here. Hi, Todd. Hi, John.
So for folks who do not know John, I will say that there will be some Microsoft followers who will be ecstatic to know that John is on the show. He was a 36-year veteran of Microsoft, and I have to say, in all of my time covering the company, there are only a couple people who I've only heard universally positive things about in my discussions with people inside the company, and John is one. He is a longtime engineering leader. He worked behind the scenes on everything from some of Microsoft's first Mac applications to basically saving their butt on Windows 7, although I'm sure he probably wouldn't put it that way. But John is now immersed in the world of political reform, and he's on the board of Represent Us, a political reform advocacy group. He has been acting behind the scenes in a lot of this discussion and debate over political funding and donations. And John, before we jump into all that, because it's obviously a very timely topic given what's happening even this week in Washington, D.C. with the impeachment proceedings, tell us the story of how you got into this, because I do understand it involved an offhanded remark at one point by Orrin Hatch.
Yes, it does. So think back in time. It's about the year 2000. Microsoft is in the throes of its antitrust trial. And Orrin Hatch, in veiled but clear language, tells Microsoft, you know, if you'd have been giving your political contributions, you wouldn't have any of this trouble now, which is a fantastically corrupt thing. And of course, we weren't dummies at Microsoft. Not dummies now either, just to be clear. But so we started giving our political contributions. That's when the Microsoft PAC was created. It was an insider seat that I had to see how ridiculous it was and how wrong it was. But necessary if you wanted to have a seat at the table in government. So when I left in 2014, I started investigating how we can fix this. And that's how I came to know Represent Us, which is I like because it's of its execution ability, the way it talks about the political system as having been corrupted, and also the set of policies that we champion around the country to fix it and make it not have to be a pay-to-play system anymore.
And John, this has obviously been in the news even more than usual lately because of the events at the U.S. Capitol and the opposition to the certification of the election and the related questions over political donations by companies to legislators who supported those efforts. Can you give us your perspective on the last month in the context of the political reform work that you've been doing?
I think that January 6, 2021 was American democracy's 9/11. A lot of people who were working in the political system and thought that was just the way it was had a wake-up moment to understand that the system can't go on like it was. And I'm glad to see Microsoft, along with other companies, making that realization. And I think what happens from that point forward and from this point forward is somewhat an open book yet to be written. And I hope we can write something that's really strong that will result in repairing our democracy so we have confidence that our democracy is not under threat and also fix the problems that got us to this point.
John, you're a technologist. I'm curious whether this is a problem that you think technology actually can solve.
I don't know that technology can solve it on its own directly. I actually have been coming at the problem more from the systems perspective that I developed while working at Microsoft. When there was a bug or a class of bugs, and you didn't just go and fix them, you actually asked, how did this bug happen? What were the underlying conditions? How could we have structured the engineering process differently so that this bug wouldn't have happened? And that's the same kind of thinking that has to go on here. It's not going to be enough just to beat a few politicians in a few elections. We have to go back and examine things like the incentive structure. Why are politicians behaving the way that they behave? There are two excellent papers, and I hope we can put the links to them on the site with the podcast.
Absolutely.
One is from Princeton, and it pointed out how the current economic system, with the way that people get access to Congress, basically means that regular people have basically zero impact on what laws get passed. Zero impact. And that just isn't right. Interestingly, when they filtered for wealth and company status, there was an impact on what people wanted to have happen and what actually happened. So it's a fascinating skew. The second paper is by Michael Porter, the Harvard Business School strategy professor, talking about the structure of our political system as a duopoly. And it's really amazing when you think about how the Republican Party behaves, how the Democratic Party behaves. It really fits the incentive structure of a duopoly. And, if we don't make progress on the influence of money and the hyper-partisanship caused by the duopoly, we won't really fix the system. We have to go and look at those underlying issues and fix those.
Yeah, John, I had a question on that. In fact, it's interesting to hear you describe it as a systems problem and a bug, kind of in this antivirus software kind of mindset, because this is the second time I've had a former Microsoft person in the past week kind of describe it to me. I don't know, you probably know Rich Tong, the former VP of marketing at Microsoft.
I do.
Who's really kind of going down the rabbit hole of trying to solve the disinformation problem that we face as a country. And, he used this phrase, which I just love, that we need an antivirus for thought. And so my question is, which I thought it was just brilliant. My question is, I see what you're trying to do here with like money and politics and corruption, but boy, it seems like it's almost further down the path of where we need to be as a country. It seems like the first issue at hand is like, we got to find some basic common ground of truth and basic information flow before you even get to the point of the problem that you're trying to solve. How are you addressing that issue?
Well, that's interesting. First of all, I agree that disinformation is a huge problem. The sequencing of it, I think, is workable in where we are now. We absolutely have to figure out what to do about disinformation. And, what's interesting is that duopoly structure and the incentives that that creates is a way that the political parties don't push back on people foisting the disinformation. And, just recently we had the president of the United States foisting the disinformation. So if we can change the incentives, then the disinformation will settle down. But I agree that in the long run, we still have to do a lot of work to figure out how to make sure that the marketplace of ideas is really competitive. And there's a lot being written about that now. One of the top reforms to try to get the political debate to steer away from disinformation is this thing called ranked choice voting or instant runoff voting. Have you heard of it?
I'm not familiar with it.
Yeah, please explain it, John.
We just had a good victory in Alaska, where Alaska adopted a nonpartisan top four primary so that the top four candidates in the primary will advance to the general election. And then in the general election, you'll vote by ranking the candidate, saying, I want this candidate first. That's my first choice. This is my second choice. This is my third choice. And what that system does, first of all, the ability of a political party to primary someone who's not behaving according to the political party's needs doesn't have to worry about getting primaried. They can make it through the top four and get into the general election. And then in the general election, when there are more than two candidates and people can rank, they don't have to have this vote for the lesser of two evils problem. They can vote for the person that they really want and be assured that they're not ensuring that the worst possible outcome is going to happen. And an amazing dynamic happens, and we've seen this in Maine and other places that have adopted ranked choice voting, is that the whole political debate de-escalates because candidates realize that they want to compete for the number one choice, but they realize that they also have to compete for the number two choice in order to be successful. And so it loosens the grip of the political party dogma, gives people real choice, and smooths and calms the political debate. So you can't win elections just by demonizing the other side anymore, which is a key part of the disinformation, source of disinformation.
John, are there obstacles to adoption in the system, or is this simply a matter of awareness to get something like ranked choice in more elections around the country?
Yeah, because the political parties don't really like it, it typically has to really come from people in a grassroots movement. So that's the obstacle. In Washington, there's a group here called Fair Vote Washington, and they've been championing a bill. It's in the legislature, House Bill 1156, that would allow local governments to use ranked choice voting in their elections. And so there are definitely actions that you can take to help support that in the legislature right now. Nationally, it really has to do with building coalitions. When you look at the success of the Alaska bill that just passed this year, that's the result of first of all, great people from Alaska wanting to champion change, and then a variety of groups coming together and working together to create the conditions where it could win. Represent Us, one of the things that I like about Represent Us is we sign people up. We have over 1 million people signed up, and then we can ask them to volunteer. So I text banked for the bill in Alaska. And so all the coalition building adds up to being able to be successful.
We're talking with John Devon. He is a former longtime Microsoft executive, currently on the board of Represent Us, a political reform group. John, one of the things that strikes me is that there's another person from Microsoft's past who actually relates very directly to this, and I want to bring him up coming up next. You're listening to GeekWire.
Technology moves fast. I need to move faster. WGU's competency-based education puts me in control of how fast I move through my IT degree program. I can accelerate my program by applying what I already know to my courses and focusing on the things I need to learn. Earn a respected accredited degree that propels your career in the IT field. Learn more at wgu.edu/IT certs included.
Welcome back. It's Todd Bishop with John Cook. Our guest this week is John Devon. He is a longtime former Microsoft executive, currently very heavily involved in the political reform movement as a board member of Represent Us. John Cook, as you were saying this earlier, it struck me that the issue of disinformation is something that former Microsoft CEO Steve Ballmer is taking on with USA Facts. And of course, we've worked with Steve on various projects, including our Numbers Geek podcast in the past. So I have had a front row seat for this. John Devon, it strikes me that that antitrust experience that Microsoft went through was formative for a lot of you. And I recognize Steve Ballmer's involvement in USA Facts is different motivations and perhaps different origins. But did that experience turn all of you Microsoft execs who went through it into political reform activists? What's the deal?
Certainly, my personal experience bears that out. And I think you see this in a lot of companies. In fact, Brad Smith, in a podcast he did with Kara Swisher recently, talked about the 6 stages of antitrust grief or something like that. And, you know, we were definitely in stage one, you know, government, we're here doing our thing. We don't even want to think about you. We're just going to do what we think is right for our customers and our business. And that antitrust trial was the wake-up call on that front. And then all the other things that Brad talked about no, you don't understand what we do. And all the way through to the, you know, the last stage is actually, okay, we see what's expected of us to be a responsible company. And, you know, it's actually okay to be here, and we can move forward with that. I think that's definitely something that Microsoft went through. And as such, I think all of us have our points of view about the media ecosystem and how that works, all the lobbying that goes on that creates momentum for ideas. And then for me, it's just how the political system ought to work, how we grew up thinking, you know, just the schoolhouse rock, how does a bill come to be, right? And this idealism around democracy, and we want that, we want it to be that way.
John, what's your sense, just fast forwarding to today, on the whole movement towards antitrust? I mean, it does seem like there's a bit of an issue. I mean, you're all about kind of consensus and bringing people together. It seems like there's a bit of consensus with Democrats and Republicans around antitrust. I'm curious how you see that playing out here under this new administration, having gone through what you went through at Microsoft.
Yeah, I don't have any kind of informed opinion about how that's happening right now. I haven't been following it close enough. To me, I've been looking at the issues more relevant to the information ecosystem, to your earlier question. And clearly, we have to figure out something about how algorithms amplify completely untrue things. That has to be figured out. I don't know what to say about, you know, how would you break these companies up or regulate them and what the regulations ought to be. I don't know.
Yeah, well, let's stick on the information component of that. Let me ask it this way. I think this does become an antitrust concern as it relates to Facebook and their impact on elections, which obviously ties into your focus now. If you were the head of engineering at Facebook today, what would you implement day one to try to fix the current problem we all face?
Yeah, that's a good question. I think maybe some kind of circuit breaker on what gets promoted algorithmically, that at some point, you know, you see something is being promoted rapidly. And at that point, maybe I have a responsibility to make sure that that's actually true. Maybe I don't know. That's probably the one idea I have.
Todd and I, coming out of the media world, you know, we have to moderate content all the time, and it's a people heavy burden. You know, you have to have a lot of people behind it. And it seems like the tech companies have tried to figure it out through algorithms and automation and technology. Do you see a way to do this through technology in terms of that circuit breaker approach you mentioned, or does it turn into like a people issue that you need to put real eyeballs behind it?
Yeah. You know, I'm not expert enough in the machine learning aspects that might be able to be applied here. In theory, it could be, but you know, you have all the inherent bias issues that go along with it. I know from some experience at Microsoft and when it was doing some moderation of content, those were very difficult jobs. And it might be better to have machines doing it, because it can be very difficult for a human.
Right. It can be traumatic, even given the things that they have to see to be able to filter out. I know that from covering a little bit of it. John, the other interesting aspect of this right now is just the question of how companies, in the meantime, while we're all waiting for these better systems, figure out what to do about money in politics and influence. And you mentioned Brad Smith earlier, and he made headlines a couple weeks ago. And actually, that's how we connected again, John, because you offered some very ombudsman-like advice to Microsoft on Twitter. But Brad Smith spoke candidly in an internal meeting about the need for a political action committee, going back even to the Orrin Hatch comments. I mean, really, he was saying, hey, look, he didn't say this literally, but what Orrin Hatch told us was unfortunately true. It was the gist that if we don't, through our political action committee, make donations, we can't build the relationships that we need in Washington, D.C. as Microsoft to get done what we want to get done. He was very careful in not making it a direct quid pro quo, but clearly it spoke to what I think you would call the corrupt system. And more recently, Microsoft did announce that it will not be donating in the 2022 election cycle to any members of Congress who voted against certifying the results of the U.S. presidential election, is one example. What should companies do right now while we're waiting for reform?
I think there are some real opportunities right now. First of all companies that have paused their donations, I think that's a very positive thing. And I hope that they join Microsoft at least in the embargo of donations to people who contributed to what happened on January 6th. I think that's really a bare minimum. There is a historic opportunity right now to support the For the People Act, H.R. 1, in Congress. It gets positioned as a Democratic Party thing that's bad for Republicans, but it's really not. It really is about, you know, if you have concerns about making sure that voter rolls are accurate, if you have concerns about that votes are secure and that you can do audits to make sure that the election results are correct, you want H.R. 1 to pass. This notion of how politicians choose their voters instead of voters choosing their politicians through gerrymandering, if you don't like that idea, and gerrymandering is probably the number one cause that leads to polarization, if you don't like that, H.R. 1 makes gerrymandering happen in a nonpartisan way. Really important. If you don't like the way that money and lobbying influence works in Congress, H.R. 1 helps that. And it has some beginnings on helping balance the powers so that the executive branch just can't ignore the oversight capabilities of Congress. So those are all really positive things. They are not partisan in any way. They are just about making the system better, make it easier for citizens to express their will at the ballot box, and in a way that, you know, hopefully will foster honest and reasonable debate going into the future.
We're talking with John Devon. He is a longtime former Microsoft engineering leader who is now a political reform activist. We'll have more coming up next. You're listening to GeekWire. Welcome back. It's Todd Bishop with John Cook. We're talking with John Devon. And John, as I mentioned earlier, I think a lot of the Microsoft fans out there will be very thrilled to have you on. Before we jump into the rest of the political discussion, I got to ask you, what are your thoughts on just overall technology? What are you using in your daily life, if you don't mind me asking?
I guess I'm probably pretty old-fashioned, actually.
Using a PC and all that?
Yeah. Well, I have a thing where for my birthday, I build myself a PC every year.
That's your birthday gift to yourself?
That's my birthday gift to myself.
That's very, very geeky.
It's very geeky. I find it very fun. I have a video card that's way too expensive for what I actually need, but that's another whole thing. But, you know, the pandemic and using all the video conferencing, you know, I hadn't even really tried to use video conferencing since the old ISDN conference room sessions. So I'm very gratified that video conferencing works so well over the internet. It's kind of a miracle. And I can actually see you. You're not 1 inch by 1 inch on my screen. So that's good. You know, it's interesting. You know, if I were still working at Microsoft, I probably wouldn't have quite as much experience kind of comparing the Google apps, which are very popular in the nonprofit space, and the Microsoft apps. I'm still clearly a Microsoft apps champion and pretty much always return there whenever I can.
John, let me ask you, I just had a follow-up on that because your experience at Microsoft was so interesting, and it's been an amazing story for us to cover at GeekWire, the rebirth under Satya Nadella. If you were to like choose a group or team or product that you could work on at Microsoft right now, what would it be and why? Like, what do you think is the coolest thing they're working on that as an engineer, you just like, I want to get in there and help build this product out?
Well, that's an interesting question. Actually, right this minute, it would be Democracy Forward, even though that's not a technology product.
This is the initiative that they announced a couple weeks ago, along with these steps to freeze the funding. Yep.
Right. And to kind of return to that, the notion that a company engages in the political system as it is, you know, I think a company has a right to do that. And if they think they must, I won't judge them harshly. But I think given everything that's happened, they also have to be involved in helping to reform the system, because it should not be pay to play to get access and have the relationships. I mean, think about it, a company like Microsoft absolutely should have a seat at the table on a whole host of policy issues. They shouldn't have to pay money to have that seat at the table. It's ridiculous. I'm really hopeful that Democracy Forward, as it gets fleshed out and what Microsoft does with it, and hopefully also brings a bunch of other companies along to bring them into the reform discussion and movement, is an important thing.
Yeah, John, one of the things that struck me about the organization you're involved with now in terms of reforming the political system ties into the messaging. I just spent a little bit of time on the site, and I was struck by the use of the word corruption, I think, is what really stuck with me. And you've seen that term certainly used a lot here by a fringe element that's become a larger movement of the Republican Party, that the system is fully corrupt. And I was just having a hard time balancing that based on what you're saying here in Money and Politics and this other use of the word corruption, and kind of tying back into my, I think it's tied into the misinformation component of this. And I don't know. I was having a hard time squaring that. I was trying to learn more about the organization. How do you balance that? What are your thoughts when I mentioned that?
Well, I think this is a good example of Colin Powell saying, you know, your battle plan never survives actual contact with the enemy. it is a challenge, because particularly people who are skilled at disinformation try to turn arguments in a projective way against their opponents. And I think that's what's going on here with that particular use of corruption. But that's what one of the things which is really challenging about the reform area is it is very fluid, because for all the things that we want to accomplish, there are people in the opposition, and they're also smart people, and they can come up with ways to counteract to try and get what they want. I firmly believe there are more people that want the political system to work for everyone and not just a few, but you know, we do have to fight for it.
So what would you, or what would Represent Us do with money? How would you handle the whole issue of campaign finance?
So our policy is a thing we call the American Anti-Corruption Act. And actually back in 2015, that Anti-Corruption Act was used as a starting point for what eventually became the Seattle Honest Elections Law. So the way that public financing works in Seattle, with the ethics board and the public vouchers, we see is the best way to do public financing of campaigns. And we believe that all campaigns should be publicly financed.
What do you think of Seattle's implementation of it as it would stack up against the ideal?
You know, I think it's working pretty well. You're seeing the amount of money that flows into elections becoming much more even. It's not just the high wealth zip codes that are contributing money to elections now. I think that's a really positive thing. You're seeing a lot more people run, and I think that's a really positive thing. And, you know, that has to lead to better representation of people inside the city. And we have some tough issues inside the city now, right, with homelessness and Amazon and other things. And as far as I can tell, the citizens aren't necessarily super aligned on what should happen. And so I think that means we have to have more voices inside the political process trying to influence it so that we can figure it out.
One other question on my list, John, relates tangentially to a news item this past week, and that was President Biden effectively froze the executive order that would have forced the sale of TikTok to Oracle and Walmart, a group involving them. And of course, that tangentially relates to Microsoft because Microsoft bid on it. I'd love to ask you for your take on TikTok, but I'm sure you'd probably pass on that one. What role do you think executive orders play in all of this? They end up being such a fluid and reversible action and a unilateral action at the same time. How does that play into the reform movement?
Yeah, there's a lot of discussion about that now and how that should work. I think people can say that Congress should be working. And if Congress were working, there'd be a lot fewer executive actions. The idea that Congress passes the law and then the executive branch implements and enforces the law is the model that we should use. Should there be a law passed to clarify when you can use executive orders and not use executive orders? Probably. I would rank the executive branch has to respond to congressional subpoenas over that one. And also the ethics rules and have some teeth behind the ethics rules ahead of that one. But I think that we are a democracy and laws should be made by the legislative branch.
John, this is great. We're coming to the end of our time here, but we greatly appreciate you sharing these insights. I learned a lot. I'm wondering, is there a call to action, something that the listeners out there should do that you would recommend just as a first step or a way to engage? What would you have folks do?
My parochial response is you should go to represent.us and sign up. And that's a good step. There's also the Fair Vote Law that if you want to get involved in passing ranked choice voting in Washington, that's a cool thing that you can do right now. I'd like to add to the page with the podcast, my reading list. If people want to learn more about the democracy reform movement and what the problems are, and then a set of groups that are worth looking into to try to understand more about what's happening in the movement, to look at those too.
You got it. Yeah, send it my way. We'll put it up there right into the post.
So what's the number one book you would recommend for me if I want to dive into this in a deeper way?
Dark Money by Jane Meyer.
Great title.
If you want to understand a lot of the dynamics of how we ended up where we are, if you want to understand the kind of urgent issues exposed by January 6th, there's a book, How Democracies Die, that is also really important, I think.
Great recommendations.
Thank you.
Not always uplifting reading, but important reading.
John Devon, thank you very much for joining us.
My pleasure. Hope to talk again sometime soon.
Absolutely. John Devon is a longtime former engineering leader at Microsoft and a board member of the group Represent Us. We will link to everything that he discussed and more in the show notes on this episode. Thanks, everybody, for listening to GeekWire. Our podcast producer is Kurt Milton. Our theme music is by Daniel L.K. Caldwell. To see all of GeekWire's coverage of science, tech, business, and more, go to geekwire.com and sign up for our daily email newsletter to receive all of our stories. Until next time, I'm Todd Bishop.
And I'm John Cook.
Thanks for listening to GeekWire.